I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with a Deal, and today our guest is Bomi Lee, an M&A partner at Fenwick & West. Bomi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, David, for having me.
We're going to talk about several things on today's podcast, a little bit about your background, how you came to practice M&A, your move to tech M&A and Fenwick, your work on the Symantec Veritas carve out, the transition to partner and what that change is like, and finally, your life outside of work. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the practice of law.
Well, I have a very unique answer. I did not want to be a lawyer. I never thought about being a lawyer. I'm sure no one on your podcast has ever said that before. I come from a background, grew up mostly in Korea. My dad did his PhD in the States. He studies medieval history. He's a professor of medieval history. He's pure academic. Most of my formative years, I lived in Korea. I don't think I had much familiarity, if any, of the U.S. legal system. And you know, I was just going about my life in Korea. I graduated college and I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I joined the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Korea as a translator interpreter for a couple of years and ended up sitting in on a lot of really interesting conversations, one of which was trade negotiations with the U.S. between the U.S. and Korea. I had no idea what I was saying. I was just interpreting words. And so I didn't really understand the substance of the negotiations, but I liked sitting at the table and I thought, how can I become a principal? Little did I know being an M&A lawyer is not being a principal, but at the time that led me to law school and pursuing a legal career.
And so how did you find your way into M&A?
Well, after law school, I still didn't know what I wanted to do. I think I probably knew less of what I wanted to do than before I entered law school. And I did what everyone else does, which is join a big New York law firm. I joined Cravath, and one of the attractions for me to Cravath was their rotation system. They have a rotation system where you rotate through different practice areas in the corporate group, and it allowed me to defer making any decision of any kind of what I wanted to do, which is, as a liberal arts major, that's basically what your goal is in life, is to defer any decision making. So I did some IPO work. I did a lot of financing work. I worked in the debt financing group for a couple of years. And then I joined the capital markets group that ended up doing a lot of sponsor financing, acquisition financing work. So I got a lot of different experience. And then finally, my last rotation before I left Cravath was in M&A. And that's when I worked on a few transactions where it really clicked. Like, this is what I like to do. This is more my speed. This is just much more interesting to me. And there are a couple of deals that I remember making a big impression. The first was I was a senior associate on a public company sell side deal for Integrys, a utilities company in the Midwest. They were selling to Wisconsin Energy, and it was a cash stock mixed deal. And that was the first time I was really kind of digging into fiduciary duty issues. And it was all, I think, relatively boilerplate sell side M&A. The conversation that I remember that was really interesting to me was we were in the board meeting deliberating about the deal. And one of the board members asked, well, what's happening to all of the employees in Green Bay? Because with Integrys was based in Green Bay, this was a merger where they were going to re-headquarter to the Wisconsin Energy plant headquarters in Milwaukee. And he said, there are 400, or I can't remember the exact number, middle managers and senior managers in Integrys that are probably going to be terminated in connection with this deal. And that's when it clicked for me. Like, when we were talking about deal synergies, we were talking about people and we were talking about reduction of workforce. And it was going to have a big impact on the community. It was going to have a big impact on individual lives. And it just, the feeling that what we were working on was that tangible. And remember, I had a financing background, and financing lawyers are frankly the smartest people that I've ever met in my life. They are great draftsmen. They are really good at thinking conceptually on vague terms. Because in a financing document, you're talking about and you're drafting for future events that haven't yet happened, that may happen within the time of the loan. Whereas there's just an immediacy about M&A and a tangibility about M&A that I really appreciated, that resonated with me a lot more than financing work that I had done previously. That was one thing that I remember. And then the other deal that I worked on was a hostile takeover. And if anyone's done a hostile takeover, it's very memorable. But we were representing a consortium of two different parties, the Cotrali Group and the Safra Group, in their acquisition of Chiquita Bananas. And so Chiquita had already signed a merger agreement with Fife's. I think it was Fife's was like the third leading banana company in the world. And Chiquita was the fourth leading banana company in the world. And they had already had a merger agreement in place. The shareholders meeting was rapidly approaching, and our client came to us and said, number one, we want to buy this target. And number two, we want a lengthy diligence process. And again, if anyone's done a hostile takeover process, you don't get a lengthy diligence process. So we had to come up with a way to convince the shareholders not to vote down the deal and take our deal, because we didn't have a deal yet. We wanted to do our diligence. We didn't have a real offer on the table. So we had to say, we launched a hostile saying, don't vote down the deal, just postpone the deal so that we have time so that we can do our diligence and we can put an attractive offer in place. And so it was a lot of communication work, a lot of PR work, working with Innisfree, the proxy advisors on our side, talking to the proxy solicitors. And it was just the strategic element of all of that was so fun for me, something that I'd never experienced before. Innisfree initially said, vote to postpone the deal. And then when we finally finished our diligence and made our offer, they said, actually, vote for the Fife deal, vote against the Cotrali Safra Group. And then the day before the shareholders meeting for Fife, we bumped our price by 50 cents and Innisfree switched their recommendation. And so all of that kind of playing out real time, we were in a war room, and to go to the Fife shareholder meeting, we had a kind of a room to the side, the conference room to the side. We watched that shareholders meeting, then that deal get voted down. We immediately went into the conference room next door and for the next 24 hours negotiated a merger agreement and signed in a couple of days after that. And so the actual merger agreement negotiation process, the drafting, all of that happened within 24 hours. But we had been working on the transaction for 2.5 months kind of prior to that. And so the strategic element, the thinking about how emotionally the board members might feel if we said something, thinking about how emotionally the shareholders might feel if we were saying abandon the bird in the hand in exchange for something unknown that we say is better, but we haven't fully put an offer in place. Like, how do you get people to buy into that, to give you that extra time? And just thinking strategically about within the realms of using the tools that we have, how do we get the client the result that they want? There was just a human emotion aspect to it that I thought was so interesting. And again, much more tangible than some of the financing work that I had done before. So I think those two deals kind of clinched it for me. I was like, this is fun. I like the strategy and the negotiations and the chess game element of M&A. I really like the immediacy of M&A and the tangible results of M&A. And so that's when I decided that that's kind of what I wanted to do going forward.
And so how did you decide to focus on tech M&A and consider your options and ultimately decide to go to Fenwick?
I took a look around the companies that were doing deals. Number one, I looked at what companies are doing a lot of deals. And this was in 2015, and tech was just doing a lot of deals. It was starting to do a lot of deals. The California firms were really active. New York hadn't quite penetrated over there. I think some of the firms made some satellite offices, not as vigorously as some of the native law firms out here. And so when I came and interviewed out in California, just try to survey the landscape, I did interview at some firms that were New York satellite offices. And then I interviewed at firms that were kind of native California, native Silicon Valley. And ultimately, I decided if I'm going to do tech M&A, I want to do it in a place where the whole infrastructure is built for tech M&A. That's what Fenwick does. It is just tech and life sciences. That is our core focus. That has always been our core focus. It's not just because that's where the money is right now. It's because that's what the entire firm has been built around. Our technology lawyers are super. Our tax lawyers are working with technology companies and are really attuned to the issues around intangible assets and how valuable that is, as opposed to working with necessarily with companies that are brick and mortar or utilities. It's just the whole firm is oriented around supporting tech and life sciences clients. That was really attractive to me. And when I was making my decision, I was like, well, I know what a big non-industry focused law firm is like, but I don't know what an industry focused law firm is like where I can completely dive into a certain segment of the market. So that was attractive to me to try out.
And then talk about integrating yourself into Fenwick and the deal by which you did that, the Symantec Veritas deal.
So that was the first deal I joined when I joined Fenwick. I think I just got really lucky or unlucky, depending on how you look at it, because I think I built 300 hours my first month. It was a divestiture of a significant portion of Symantec's business. Symantec had an information security business and an information management system, and they had combined the two and hadn't quite worked out the way that they had wanted. So they decided ultimately to spin off their information management system into a separate public company. In the process, there were some interested third-party buyers, and instead of pursuing the spin, they decided to go with the sale. So that's when I got involved. And the really interesting part about a divestiture of a business unit is that in a normal M&A deal, you do your diligence, but you kind of are looking for red flags. You're looking at high-level things. You're not trying to construct basically a balance sheet from bottoms up, which is the kind of exercise you need to do in a business carve-out. What that means is you need to figure out which chair in the office belongs to which entity and who gets it. It's the pencils, it's the chairs, but much more complicated, obviously, is if for, especially for companies that we're dealing with, is the IP. And I've done a lot of these over the years, and you talk to people at various different levels in the company. You're talking to not just the finance team, the CFO, or maybe the VP of finance, but you're talking to people kind of at the third layer down who are really dealing with the day-to-day management of some of the finances of that particular business unit. And so by getting pulled onto that particular deal and having to get so deep into that company and working with all of our, on our side, the specialist teams, I just got really quickly integrated into the firm. The hard thing about being a lateral associate is you don't know people outside of your immediate field. Like, you know the senior associate, you know the mid-level associate, you know the junior associate, and of course, you know the partner in M&A, but you don't have that tax colleague that you can go to and say, hey, I have a really dumb question, and you just walk me through this issue, or a lawyer who you can just go to and say, hey, can you just gut check me on this? Because those are the relationships that you develop as you're doing multiple deals over multiple different transactions. And you kind of lose that all at once when you're a lateral associate, and you have to rebuild that at the same time. And so by immersing myself in this deal and really kind of getting into a deal that was very nitty gritty and that we were all spending hours and hours trying to help the company figure out where its assets are and where its liabilities are and who they belong to, I kind of immediately jumped into a network and immediately developed relationships with a lot of the key people that have made my career what it is today. So I became a Fenwickian within the course of like a deal.
So talk about carve-outs more generally. You're seeing companies think about them now because it's a little bit more of a challenging M&A environment. Talk about how you advise companies in carve-outs, the challenges, you know, maybe the opportunities, maybe when a carve-out that turns out doesn't make sense.
Yeah, so I think you're right. This is the time when a lot of companies are looking at their portfolios and they say, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense? I think in a upmarket, all companies want to add products. They want to expand revenue. They want to get into different segments that they're not already in today, and they're making investments. And so you see a lot of acquisitions. In a down market, people are tightening their belts. They're saying, what are the investments that we're making that are not having the ROI that we want? How can we streamline our portfolio? Where can we become leaner? And so you see products coming off the market. You see product lines getting shut down, and you see companies thinking about, how can I monetize some of the immediate value for an investment that I no longer want to make? And so We've been talking to a lot of companies in the last year, maybe or so, about potential acquisitions that we had advised them on, you know, 5 to 10 years ago that hadn't worked out so well that they now want to divest, or organically grown products that, again, need a lot of investment and just aren't consistent with the strategic goal of the company anymore. And so I think we're seeing a lot of companies think about divestitures, think about carve-outs. And now I have a checklist to go through with clients who are thinking about this to say, okay, what does this actually mean? And can you do it? And what's the decision tree to figure out whether it makes sense to shut down this business, whether it makes sense to sell this business, or whether it makes sense to continue to invest in this business? And one of the big questions that companies struggle to figure out, and we try to help them think about, is, again, what comprises the business that we're talking about and what would make it attractive to a buyer? And I can't tell you how many times I have conversations with clients where they're like, oh, you know, it's a relatively separate business. They have a separate P&L. Like, don't worry about it. We're not very integrated at all. And we say, okay, well, let's look at this from a line by line perspective and tell me if that's actually true. And so if you think about, they're like, oh yeah, they have their own customers. And again, we have our own profits for them, and it's a separate P&L. And you say, well, okay, how does that revenue get generated? Is it through a contract? And they say, yes, it's through a contract. And we say, okay, well, who are the parties to the contract? And it turns out that is actually a giant MSA, a master services agreement that has all of the other products of the company. And yes, it's a separate SKU. There's a separate line item for this product that you want to sell, but it's part of this master agreement. And then you're like, okay, well, how does a third party customer going to feel if you have to negotiate a separate agreement for them with this other buyer? Is that feasible, or are they going to be pissed off? And how are they actually buying under this contract? If it's just you pay $10 per license, it's pretty easy. You can probably just duplicate the contract and say, now you can buy it from this person, this new owner, for $10. Easy. It's a lot harder. It happens a lot in tech companies where it's like an all-you-can-eat model where you say, oh, you pay us $100, a subscription model, you pay us $100, and you get access to all of these products. How do you price just one of them? If you take that product out of the litany, is the customer going to be happy? Is the customer going to be unhappy? Is it going to affect the rest of your business line? So actually thinking about it, not just from a business perspective and a P&L perspective, but thinking about how the business that you're selling attaches to assets and the title of those assets and what the structure of that legally, helping clients think through that, I think is the first step, because we kind of need to figure out how much of the spaghetti is tangled. And then you go through the work of, okay, it's the people, it's the technology, it's the assets, it's the fixed assets, it's the leases. Are they all in the same building, and or are they in different buildings? Just really going through the categories of different things that you would have to untangle if you were to separate out the business units. And a lot of the time, the people that we're interfacing with don't have the answers. They're only kind of there at the G&A level, right? And they're not the overhead level, and they're not really integrated with the business because they're part of the bigger corporate. And so trying to figure out those answers and figure out how hard it would be to do this separation takes a lot of time. Advice I have for clients who are considering this is involve your accountants early and involve your lawyers early, because we'll help you figure out how hard this will be. I think you're right. Sometimes the answer is, you know what? It's too hard. It's probably better. You're not going to get much value out of this. It's actually too integrated with your business, and it's going to piss your customers off if you sell this off. You're not going to get enough money for it. Or better for you to just end of life this product and shut it down and do it in an elegant way that is inconsistent with your terms of service. It will affect your existing businesses less. Or you could get a lot of value for this, but it's going to take a year, and we're going to need to do a full audit, and you need to bring your auditors in to do breakout fully audited financials, because any interested buyer would want financing for this. Whatever the answer is, kind of getting your advisors involved early will really help you think through the elements of a carve out, because it's very easy. I see a lot of clients do say, okay, it's relatively separate, it's not going to be that bad. And then a year later, you're still talking about the same things.
So the process itself can take months before you get to a decision about whether to do the carve out, shut the business down, run the business for a period of time in a maybe a wind down mode.
And that's right. I think that's why people are reluctant to get lawyers involved early, because they're like, well, I don't want to do all of that work if I'm ultimately not going to sell. And what I would say is it's not really, there's not a lot of work for the lawyers to do. It's just the lawyers can ask the right questions, help you think through the right thing, walk you through my checklist, walk you through the asset buckets, so that you can go and formulate that view internally, do kind of a lot of the legwork up front. And again, we've done carve outs very quickly. The trade-off, though, is if you don't do that legwork up front, you will have to live with a pretty entangled, intertwined third party. After you sell the business, there's still going to be a transition services agreement. There's still going to be licenses. There's still going to be contractual arrangements so that you're not doing anything that disrupts your existing business. So there's a way to do it that is faster if there is enough value on the other end. It's just thinking through it with the lawyers on the front end will help you decide which path you want to go down relatively in a more thoughtful way.
Switching gears a little bit, talk about the transition from senior associate to partner and what changes.
Couple of things. I think the title matters. Being called a partner, I think, changes how associates interface with you, how other partners interface with you, and most importantly, maybe how clients interface with you. I don't think that the day-to-day changed for me very much or immediately, but the way that clients would call me a little bit earlier than they would call me as a senior associate for advice or consultation, how other partners called me for talk about different issues, I think changed a little bit. So I do think that the title really did change more than I expected it to. And then opportunities came, people who I had known for a while, who had never called me about deals or for their companies, started to call and say, hey, I heard you're a partner at Benwick. I have this matter. Is there anyone that could help me with this? Do you know anyone, or could you help me with this? So I think the referrals started to happen again quicker than I thought. And I think it is really just based on the title, because I don't think anything that I did changed, like nothing fundamental changed. So I think that was one thing. And then the other thing that was surprising was how quickly my own perspective changed. You kind of go from being an employee to a shareholder when you make partner, which I think is really interesting. You think about the business and you think about the overall health of the company. Getting visibility into the budget, getting visibility into how we were thinking about our collections, getting visibility into how to manage associates, all of that thinking and discussions that went around management changed my perspective. And, you know, a really easy example is I was always, David, so delinquent in putting in my time. It was just very hard for me to do that. And I tried timers. I tried writing things down. I tried to keep notes. I think most lawyers say like timekeeping is like the worst thing that they dislike the most. And I was just particularly very bad at it. I would always spend an inordinate amount of time after the fact trying to recreate my day, which is not an efficient way to keep time. But then when I became partner and I kind of started getting visibility into some of these discussions, I was like, wait a second, this is how we make money. If I am delinquent in my time, then we will not get paid. Or if I underwrite my time because I don't remember what I did, I'm like, that's probably only was 2 hours. I'm probably not going to get credit from the client on the hours that I billed. And so I think that kind of clicked for me at that point. I'm still not the best at keeping my time. I get very focused on what I'm doing and then I forget. And then I talk to this client and then I look at this email and then I forget exactly how long I spent on each thing. But I'm much better at it because I have the perspective of this is how our business operates. And I was telling an associate the other day, it's kind of like being a salesperson, telling someone about the product and then just letting them walk out the door without paying. Like if you don't bill your time, that's what it amounts to.
Talk about your work on Fenwick's Diversity Steering Committee.
So the Diversity Steering Committee is relatively new. It's only been in place for a couple of years. Before we had a broader diversity committee that I think a lot of firms do, where associates, our staff and our partners all sat on. But what we realize is we do a lot of talking and then there's not a lot of action and there's not a lot of direction. And so what Fenwick did was we created a steering board. There are two partners. I'm one of the co-chairs and one of my partners, Catherine Fabian, is the other co-chair. And the other members are our chief talent officer, chief managing partner, and our chairman. And so we have a steering board that sets the policy for our firm in terms of diversity initiatives, in terms of the way that we approach different recruiting issues, performance management issues, and also client-facing diversity issues. And then what we've done under the steering board is create what we've called action committees that are intended to be very action-oriented. We have Education and Training Action Committee, a Talent Profiles and Visibility Action Committee, and a Diverse Talent Outreach Committee. And so we're still at the experiment stage. What we're trying to do is move away from just talking about things. And again, like, there is a time and a place for that. Having discussion, having robust discussions is important, but we want to move away from just talking about it. And we want to give associates the power to take action and really drive forward initiatives. One of the things that one of our action committees did over the last year was start to have dinners throughout the years with affinity groups in law schools and hear from the affinity group members what's important for them, what would be helpful for a law firm to be thinking about, what are things that you've seen other law firms do that really work well, what are the struggles that you have or you've heard other people who've graduated and gone into law firms struggle with. How can we be better? How can we be helpful? And having these informal dinners early on, not part of the recruiting process, not being one of the many social cocktail hours that you have when, during OCI, I think has helped give us some insight on what people want and what might be helpful to help certain diverse groups.
And then finally, talk a little bit about your life outside of work.
What life outside of work? So I have two young children, so they are my entire world outside of work. They're 2 and 5 months, so it's been interesting trying to make the transition from being a full-time lawyer to being a full-time lawyer and full-time parent. And so I was just talking to an associate yesterday, and I'm like, newfound appreciation for associates who do this with children. At least I was not an associate when I had children, because it is really hard to juggle being a parent and being an attorney. I think the pandemic has frankly helped me personally, and I'm in my home office right now. I'm going to pop out after this to see my toddler and say good morning and say hello. And then I'm going to take 4.5 hours of calls booked back to back afterwards. But then in between calls, if calls end early, I can go see him. I can go put my baby down for a nap during the day. All of that's possible because I'm home at work and I'm able to be in front of my computer within a second. So I think that's the luxury that work has given me. And I know there's a lot of things that we've lost because of remote work, but I do think that there's a lot of things that I have personally gained.
Bomi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.